The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, emerging from her underground physics bunker, we speak to the scientist in charge of the ATLAS detector at CERN. Up close and personal, we join the Rosetta Project as they go face-to-face with the asteroid Lutetia. Plus, a woman who can communicate by sniffing, and why 2010 might be the hottest year on record. This is a spaced-out edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. Once again, the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, is in the pod, as is The Guardian's very own Dr. Strangelove. Yes, it's Ian Sample. It's been a big week for particle physics this week. Every 2 years, scientists in this field get together for IChep, the International Conference on High Energy Physics. It's a place to share ideas, announce results, and plan the future. IChep 2010 took place last week in Paris, and the talk there was all about the Large Hadron Collider. The LHC is the largest particle accelerator in the world and spends its days smashing particles together at very, very, very high speeds, all in a bid to help advance our understanding of some of the deepest bits of nature. Fabiola Gianotti is the physicist in charge of the LHC's ATLAS experiment, and I began by asking her what her highlights from IChep were.
It was really good to show that we are very fast in collecting our data and in analyzing them. But in particular, it was very nice the fact that we could show how well the experiment worked and to present first physics results from the measurement of the W and Z production cross-section to jet production to the observation of first candidate events for top quark production. The first time, actually, that this heavy quark is observed in Europe. And also, we were also able to do some searches for new physics and put limit on new particles beyond what the Tevatron has done until now. So I think it's a very positive outcome.
So after a sort of maybe shaky start from 2 years ago, the LHC's been calibrated. It's working well. It's fair to say, is it?
Yeah, I think that we are already up to speed, and the turn on has been fast because these detectors are really working very well, and the machine as well. So in some sense, we were delayed by 1 year due to the accident 2 years ago, but now we are really catching up, I must say.
You mentioned the W and the Z, and these are the force-carrying particles for the weak nuclear force. Yes. And these have been detected before, and also the top quark, as you mentioned as well. And why is it important to replicate those things in this collider before you go on?
For us, these particles are a source of calibration and debugging and commissioning of the detectors. Okay, so this is an interest number one. And the second interest is that, of course, before opening the discovery phase, we need to rediscover, quote-unquote, the standard model. First of all, because we are operating in a new energy regime, 7TV, so we have to make sure that the known particles are produced according to what is expected. This is very interesting on its own right, because we are remeasuring the standard model in a completely new energy regime, so it has some important scientific value. But also because many of these, the production of these standard particles are background to searches for new physics, because, for instance, production of top quark pairs is one of the main background to the possible observation of a signal of supersymmetry or extra dimensions or whatever. And so we need to understand very well the standard model processes before we can undertake the discovery phase.
Ian, you've got a question.
Hi, Fabiola. Hi. I know it's too early for you to say anything on these, but I wondered if you might elaborate on this point you made earlier about your searches for new physics. What kinds of things does that really mean you're looking for?
At the moment, we are mainly preparing ourselves to the searches for new physics by measuring possible backgrounds to these searches and make sure that we understand them. We understand the detector response to them. We understand their modeling in the simulation tools that we have. Searches for new physics means essentially exploring the unknown. We are in a new energy regime, and so we are going to look for anything beyond. Beyond the standard model and see if you have any manifestation, any evidence for some new phenomena occurring. Of course, At the moment, the amount of data is very limited, but I hope that in the next months to 1 year, we have enough data to attack in a very serious way a new physics, so searching for supersymmetry, additional dimensions, and many other possible, possibly also some surprises that nature might have prepared for us.
So when you say extra particles, does that include things like dark matter?
Exactly. Dark matter is one important element. Dark matter. So we are going to look for supersymmetric particles. This is a new spectrum of particles, heavier than the known particles. Otherwise, they would have been already discovered by previous accelerators, previous machines. So we are going to look for these particles. And I must say that I'm particularly keen of discovering this elusive particle that could explain 20-25% of the universe. So this will be really a great discovery, which will also strengthen and make more clear the strong links that exist between the infinitely small, the world of elementary particles, and the infinitely big, the universe.
Now, the ATLAS detectors is one of the biggest at the Large Hadron Collider. The other one that's doing similar research would be the CMS experiment. How does yours differ from theirs, and why do you have so many detectors at the Collider?
So, first of all, there are four main experiments, big experiment at the LHC. ALICE and LHCb are dedicated experiments. They are going to study specific topics. ALICE is going to study collision between heavy ion beams, and so the formation of quark gluon plasma, which is a special state of matter that permeated the universe a few microseconds after the Big Bang. And LHCb is going to study in particular the origin of asymmetry between matter and antimatter. So these are dedicated to some specific goals and have been designed and built with a specific purpose. And with, so ATLAS and CMS are what we call general purpose experiments, meaning experiment that in principle should be able to detect and study any new phenomenon that nature has decided to put at the TV energy scale. Some of these phenomena have been, in some sense, not predicted, but there are some theories that predict some new interactions, new particles, but we don't know if these theories are correct. So perhaps nature has chosen a completely different path. And ATLAS and CMS are ready to explore this path, whatever the features of new physics is. Now, why two experiments and not just one? When we invest so much in terms of technology development, in terms of money and people in a new facility like the LHC, of course you want to exploit it in the best possible way. And having two experiments doing the same things and four experiments covering the full physics program allow us to have a better and more complete output of this machine. Combining ATLAS and CMS, for instance, will allow us to double the amount of data because both experiments are taking data. It will allow us to do important cross-checks. The two experiments are doing similar things, but they are built with somewhat different technologies, and so these are also this also provides some cross checks. So it's really a strength to have more than one detector.
A lot of people talk about how the Large Hadron Collider and the Fermilab over in America are competing for lots of things. There's a race between you to find different particles and check things. Now, the Fermilab's coming to the end of its sort of lifetime. The LHC is several times more powerful. But do you have competition within scientists at the LHC too? So between CMS and ATLAS, are you looking for the same things and rushing to publish your papers before CMS guys?
It will be perhaps not very, very, very frank to say that there is no competition, but I would like to say that there is a very healthy and very nice competition. So after all, we are friends, we are colleagues. I think this competition is very nice because it pushes the two experiments and the two collaboration to give their best, to do things well and fast, but at the same time is not a competition that has negative consequences because at the end we are going to combine our data. And so it's a stimulating competition that is very, very, very positive for the production of the physics results. So it's something that stimulates us, I will say, but and it's not something that that kills science. On the contrary, it's very stimulating for science.
Another thing that came out of the ICHEP conference was talk of essentially the next generation collider. So whether it be an international linear collider or something like that. What sort of things do physicists have on the table? What do they have in mind for the next collider, the one after the LHC, I suppose?
So there are several things on for the future that are being now discussed and prepared. Of course, people are talking about an upgrade to the LHC, both in terms of intensity of the beam, so what we call luminosity with a technical term, and energy on a longer time scale. But of course, another important element in the future of particle physics, energy physics, is the possible linear collider, so any plus and minus collider at an energy yet to be decided. This is a very, very nice machine, which would allow to make extremely precise measurement of any new particle and phenomenon discovered at the LHC. For what concerns the accelerator-based program for high energy physics, so future linear collider, the consensus is that we have to wait for the outcome of the LHC, for first LHC physics results in terms of new physics, to be able to decide the parameters of this machine and the energy, first of all. So it's a very exciting time, because we are also going to prepare for our future. So hopefully in a couple of years from now, we will have already some good indications where to go. And one thing is very nice, I must say, that for me, it's on a personal note, is to see how happy and enthusiastic are young physicists from all over the world. They jump on this data, and they are really so happy and keen of analyzing them. It is really a pleasure to see young people so enthusiastic about science.
Fantastic. Fabiola, that's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let you get on with your much more important tasks now.
Thanks so much. It was very nice to talk to you.
Fabiola Giannotti of CERN. If that's whetted your appetite for particle physics news, and you simply have to know more, head over to our science blog. There you can read a diary of the IChep meeting written by physicist John Butterworth, and you can also see a film that gives you a taste of the atmosphere in Paris last week.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, a rumor came out that Tevatron would present evidence that they'd actually seen the Higgs. So at the moment at low mass, they're saying they could exclude a Higgs if it were produced 4 times more often than we actually expect it to be produced.
So in layman's terms, they haven't found it.
So layman's, if they'd found it, we'd have heard.
That's all at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Let's have a look now at some of the science stories doing the rounds this week.
News Jack.
Global temperatures in the first half of 2010 were the hottest since records began more than a century ago. That's according to two of the world's leading climate research centres. Scientists have also released what they describe as the best evidence yet of rising long-term temperatures. The report is the first to collate 11 different indicators, from air and sea temperatures to melting ice, each one based on between 3 and 7 datasets dating back to between 1850 and the 1970s. A 51-year-old woman who was left paralysed and unable to communicate following a massive stroke has written for the first time in 7 years. The Israeli patient, who was diagnosed with locked-in syndrome, typed an emotional email to her 6 children using a revolutionary device that is controlled by sniffing. The woman was left so badly brain damaged by the stroke that she can't move any of her limbs or even blink in response to simple questions. She wrote the letter within a few days of being taught how to use the device. Doctors are investigating whether patients with an irreversible heart condition can prolong their lives by having stem cells taken from their hip and injected into the damaged organ. Experts at the Barts and the London Heart Attack Centre hope their work will lead to a major breakthrough for the UK's estimated 30,000 sufferers with dilated cardiomyopathy. The rare condition causes the heart muscle wall to become thin and floppy, making the heart progressively less able to pump blood around the body. And finally, a life of booze, fags and slothfulness may be enough to earn your doctor's disapproval, but there is one last hope, a repeat prescription of mates and good conversation. A circle of close friends and strong family ties can boost a person's health more than exercise, losing weight or quitting cigarettes and alcohol, psychologists say. Sociable people seem to reap extra rewards from their relationships by feeling less stressed, taking better care of themselves and having less risky lifestyles than those who are more isolated.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of those stories a little bit more. Ian, can you take us through the story about the woman who's written a letter by sniffing?
Yeah, so this is a bit of research out of the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and it's a novel way of getting people who are severely disabled, paraplegics and such like, and also those people who are even locked in where they are awake and conscious, but they can't move really any parts of their body in any conscious way and communicate by that. So it's a way of allowing them to communicate. And what it relies on is essentially what you might call a kind of sniff sensor. You end up with a sort of a tube under your nose that can measure changes in pressure as you move your soft palate, which is the soft bit of skin at the top of the mouth. And the really intriguing thing about this study is that most people, when they are severely disabled or they are locked in, still seem to be able to retain, or many people still seem to be able to retain control of this soft palate. So even if you can't use something like an eye tracker to tap out words on a screen, say, or by blinking, or using another method, which is sort of blowing and sucking through a little pipe that's sometimes used for controlling a mouse on a keyboard, for example, you could perhaps use this. And it's just, they've given some people the chance of writing letters for the first time in 10 years.
She wrote a letter within a few days, it seemed, of being able to use this stuff.
Yeah, and there's, so this was one patient that they tried this on. They tried it on several. They had one guy who was using it to drive his wheelchair around, but others have used it really just to type out letters and so on. You know, there's a really interesting issue here because the doctors give this capability to their patients who then start typing out notices, and you don't really know what's going to come out. And it was interesting talking to the doctors about the kind of anxieties they felt about what might come from some of these patients who have not had any communication with the outside world, really, for in one case 7 years and in another case 10 years.
I mean, I suppose the most famous example of this type of technology was Jean-Dominique Bauby, who wrote The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, using just the motion of one of his eyelids to type out an entire novel or memoir, in fact.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he was typing at about 2 minutes a letter or something like that. And the times that they achieve with this system are quicker, but you still need to have an extraordinary level of patience to be able to type this out. But if it's your only means, it sounds bad. But this is one of the doctors said to me, these people aren't doing anything else. It may be something that they would use.
The more means you have of kind of unlocking these people from the condition, I think the better it is. I think, yeah, and then you get a better idea of what these people are suffering. Yeah.
Moving on to another story now, Robin. This is the story about how 2010, according to the UK Met Office, is one of the hottest years on record. Now, I can kind of believe that from the past few weeks of weather, maybe not today, but it was a very, very cold winter.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, there's several things here. One is it's the Met Office and NASA using two different sets of measurements. They overlap a great deal. NASA says that the first half of this year has been the hottest since record began. Met Office says it's the second hottest after 1998. Interestingly enough, the Met Office made the prediction that it was more likely than not that this would be a record-breaking year for temperatures. They made that prediction in January when this country was in the middle of a massive cold spell.
I mean, the coldest for a very, very long time.
But of course, and of course, it's leapt upon by deniers. Yeah. But I mean, these are little Englanders of thinking, because yes, Europe had it, Western Europe had it bad, and so did Eastern America. On the other hand, Western America and Southeast Asia had abnormally warm conditions, which quite swamped out the cold that we were experiencing. So that by taking all the measurements they've been taking around the globe, they've been proved right. They predicted it at the beginning of the year. Having spoken to Peter Stott about this, he's the guy behind the Met Office data. He wrote a paper with several other scientists in 1999 using figures, the most recent figures he had available then were 1996, in which they predicted the most likely temperature rise between the pre-industrial era, when global warming had not yet taken its impact, and its current level in 2010 would be 0.8 degrees centigrade, and that's absolutely smack on the nose. That's exactly what we've seen. So what we're seeing is here that at a time when meteorologists and climate scientists are coming under all sorts of silly attacks from the deniers, in fact, their science is so robust that they're capable of making the most accurate predictions about the state of future weather and future climate. And as they say, every decade that we do nothing, the temperature will go up by another 0.2 degrees centigrade. Roughly by the end of this century, it will have gone up 2 degrees centigrade. And the kind of heat waves that we're seeing around Moscow, the warm weather we're seeing here, you know, you ain't seen nothing like it.
You talked about how they're accurate, the models are accurate over, but they're only accurate over long timescales, so decade-long timescales.
They've got to be decade. You're absolutely right. There's no point in comparing year by year. You've got to say this is this decade versus this decade. And they've been I'm smack on the nose at how accurate they are. It's really, it's very encouraging, but very frustrating when you see how these people who get it right are being vilified by idiots.
Did you think that after the Muir-Russell report from a couple of weeks ago and the drawing a line under the Climategate saga, that climate scientists can now get back onto actually predicting and warning again rather than being attacked? Or do you think the attacks are going to continue?
I think the attacks will continue. I don't think these guys, especially in America, have got a lot of money behind them.
You can create a lot of noise, can't you, whilst these guys might be right over 10 years. In those 10 years, whilst no one knows or no one can be factual about it.
Well, if you look at all the track record of these people in which they've opposed the science that says that smoking is risky, that acid rain is risky, that ozone holes are risky, these are quite precise sciences. And they still manage to deflect attention to the dangers by constantly pinning attention on the uncertainties that are involved. Climate's even worse. There are more uncertainties there. So there's far more scope of them to deflect attention from what is being observed. I'm sad to say, I think it won't go away, but equally neither will the temperature rises go away.
Well, there's a nice way to end there. Of course, you can read all of this stuff on guardian.co.uk/science. The European Space Agency's Rosetta probe recently did a flyby of the Lutetia asteroid. It's the largest asteroid to have been visited by a spacecraft. The stunning close-up pictures of Lutetia went around the world. But what was the mood like in the control room when the scientists were carrying out their delicate operation? Astronomy journalist and author Stuart Clark was there for us at ESA that Saturday night a few weeks back.
It's mid-morning, Saturday, July the 10th. And I'm in an industrial estate in Darmstadt, Germany. A string of European flags tell you that one of these buildings is a little different. This is the European Space Agency's Space Operations Centre. And tonight, planetary scientists and engineers in this building will shepherd a spacecraft past a mysterious asteroid millions of miles away.
This asteroid flyby is very important. It's important because although this is a mission to a comet, so the main target is a comet, the asteroid science is very important as well. And the Lutetia asteroid is our main asteroid target, meaning that is the target that was selected by the asteroid scientist as the prime target because it's scientifically so interesting.
There are some mysteries surrounding this asteroid as well, aren't there?
We know very little about the asteroid. We know its approximate size, and we know a bit of the shape because there have been some ground-based observations in preparation for the flyby, actually. And we know the rotational period. And we know a bit about, not really its composition, but what class of asteroid it could be. And so the classification that came out of it was that it is most likely a C-type asteroid, which would be an asteroid of the more primitive kind in the asteroid belt, which has most likely not changed much since the formation of the planets. So when the asteroids were left over, because they were unfortunately not put into the or agglomerated or accreted into the planets, these asteroids, if they are C-type, they are most likely still the way they were at the time of planet accretion. Then there are observations that would also indicate or hint towards that it may not be a C-type but an M-type asteroid. An M-type asteroid would be the metallic type. The M stands for metallic type. And that would mean that this asteroid would be a part of a bigger asteroid that was originally present at the time of planet formation and which then through collision was shattered. So although we hope it's a C-type, because C-type is the more primitive one, so we could look back better into the past, or more into the past, to the very time of planet formation, if it is an M-class, it is still extremely interesting, because this will be the first time spacecraft has visited an M-class. So in any case, it's a win-win situation.
6 p.m. at the European Space Operations Center in Darmstadt, Germany, on July 10th. We're just minutes away from the close encounter of ESA's deep space mission Rosetta with an asteroid called Lutetia.
I'm standing in the control room looking at the first images that have come in overnight. The spacecraft is still 2 million kilometres away from Lutetia, and yet already the OSIRIS camera is showing a distinctive shape. It's wedge-shaped. There are a few shadows on the surface, but perhaps most interestingly, at the very top, you can see a distinct arc. If that's a crater, it means that this object has been hammered by something in the past. The control room is a cross between the bridge of the Starship Enterprise and a goldfish bowl. There are computer screens everywhere. Here in Darmstadt, Germany. Things are calm but tense here now as we get to the critical moment of closest approach. Rosetta will be turning so quickly that the Earth will actually move out of its range. The Huygens antenna will no longer turn to Earth and we will lose contact with the spacecraft at that moment. At closest approach, we are completely blind. We just have to trust Rosetta to do what it's going to do. We hope to have at least one image later tonight. That's all Holger Sirks, the principal investigator of the OSIRIS camera, is promising, but secretly he's wanting some more. There are smiles all over the camera team. They have captured an image of Lutetia in the foreground, and behind it, they can clearly see Saturn, its rings fully presented. It's an absolutely picture-perfect image, and everyone is thrilled to pieces.
So we discovered tonight a new world. It's the largest asteroid ever seen by human. It's really, really cool to be here and to see these images flowing down from a spacecraft flying by with 50,000 kilometers per hour. It's great. A lot of topography, a lot of excitement we don't understand right now, and it will keep us busy for months and years working these images.
The closest approach images are here now. The camera team's inspecting them at the moment. The surface of Lutetia is strewn with boulders and grooves, but almost bowl-shaped depressions. The one thing that is taking everybody by surprise is just how heavily cratered Lutetia is. There are certain craters on there that look quite smooth, as if they've been filled in possibly with some kind of gravel or powder over the eons. And then there are other craters that look much sharper, much more jagged, perhaps almost as if they were created much more recently. This is truly a mysterious world. It reminds me somewhat of the moon of Mars, Phobos, and a little bit like the asteroid Matilda, which the NASA Near-Earth Asteroid Rendezvous spacecraft encountered a number of years ago. The camera team and the rest of the scientists are ecstatic with these images, thrilled to bits. They're saying they're more spectacular than they had imagined. No one's talking very much about scientific analysis. There's not even that much speculation going on. What is happening is that people are just looking at these images and just saying, wow.
Astronomy journalist and author Stuart Clark there in the control room at ESA. That's all for this week, folks. Thanks to The Observer's Robin McKee and to Fabiola Gianotti of CERN. Also to Mr. Science himself, Ian Sample. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.